Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, July 15th, 2025, we're delighted to host a conversation on the right on a potential solution to Title IX regulatory whiplash. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm a Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll go ahead and introduce our moderator, and I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Bob Eitel, who is co-founder and president of the Defense of Freedom Institute. He previously served as senior counselor to the Secretary of Education from 2017 through 2020, and as deputy general counsel of the U.S. Department of Education from 2005 until 2009. During his most recent tenure at the department, Mr. Eitel served on the Secretary's leadership team as a strategic and legal advisor on higher education, civil rights, and congressional oversight matters. He also served as the department's regulatory reform officer, where he was an architect of the Secretary's reforms concerning Title IX and the Higher Education Act. And during his time as Deputy General Counsel, he advised on a wide variety of regulatory, legislative, and oversight matters. Prior to joining the department in 2017, Mr. Eitel was Vice President for Regulatory Compliance Matters for several post-secondary education institutions and practiced education and employment law in Washington, D.C. And I'll leave it there. A last note throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Eitel, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. And thank you for being with us today for our conversation on the right, a potential solution to Title IX regulatory whiplash. For clarity, this will be a discussion of the legal and policy aspects of Title IX and the torturous path that the Title IX issue has taken over the years due to differing interpretation and enforcement policies by various administrations. Before we got into the conversation with our guests today, I wanted to provide some context for those who haven't really been following the Title IX issue as part of their everyday work. So as you know, Title IX was signed into law by President Nixon in 1972. And if you were to go back in time and ask someone in the last quarter of the 20th century, during the 70s, 80s, and 90s, what is Title IX? What is its purpose? You would probably hear that this is a law that ensures equal opportunities for women and girls in school athletics. Although the purpose of the law is to ensure equal opportunities for women and girls without regard to sex in education in connection with not just athletics, but also academics. But the conversation would focus, I think, most likely on the athletics issue. Now, if you were to go back 15 years or so and ask the man or woman on the street what Title IX was all about, it's quite likely that they would probably say, well, Title IX, well, that's the law that prevents sexual assault in colleges and universities. You know, that's a very serious problem. And the government is undertaking efforts under Title IX to ensure that, as a matter of Title IX compliance, their sexual assaults, sexual harassment is not occurring in higher education. It was around this time that the Obama administration began to bring attention to the issue of sexual assault on campus in higher education and the role that Title IX enforcement played in addressing such incidents. And so the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights began to hold higher ed institutions accountable for sexual assault on campus under Title IX. The athletics issue was still there, but in terms of notoriety or focus, it sort of faded into the background, with sexual assault coming to the fore. Now, if you were to go back to the beginning of the first Trump administration, it's quite likely that if you were to ask the question, what is Title IX all about, you'd hear references to this sexual assault issue on campus. You might also hear some concerns about deprivation or denial of due process and free speech on campus because of those increased enforcement efforts. That is, Title IX disciplinary proceedings in higher education were giving rise to concerns about railroading of students and suppression of academic freedom and campus free speech in the context of Title IX compliance. And as a result, these issues also entered the Title IX debate. And again, athletics sort of faded into the background, although it was still present as an issue. In 2021, if you had asked what Title IX was all about, it's quite likely that you would hear a discussion that, or at least a reference to the notion that Title IX's protections extended beyond sex to those based on gender identity. And the discussion then became one of whether Title IX provided protections based on gender identity as opposed to sex. Today, the focus is once again on women's athletics, but for different reasons than it were 50 years ago. Today, the conversation occurs in the context of what is sex? Does Title IX cover gender identity? And if so, what are the ramifications for women's athletics and frankly, private spaces, intimate facilities for women and girls on campus? What's important about all this is it's important to note that each of these errors of emphasis has resulted in a series of Dear Colleague letters, notices of interpretations, proposed rules, withdrawn proposed rules, and final regulations that have gone back and forth on these issues for years and have, I think, put, frankly, students and institutions in a bit of a situation where they experience a policy ping pong or regulatory whiplash every 3 or 4 years. So what can we do about this? We have a great panel to dig into the issue, and let me make some introductions before we begin. First up, Tyler Coward is lead counsel, government affairs at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, where he has focused on First Amendment freedoms, university censorship issues, and due process on campus. Also with us today is Sarah Perry, who is the vice president and legal fellow at Defending Education. She is a former senior counsel and former colleague of mine at the department to the assistant secretary for civil rights at the U.S. Department of Education during the first Trump administration, and is a former senior legal fellow in the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. My colleague, my DFI colleague, Paul Zimmerman, is Senior Regulatory and Policy Counsel at the Defense of Freedom Institute for Policy Studies, where his work is focused on Title IX, the Federal Student Loan Program, and teacher unions. Prior to coming to DFI, he served as counsel in the U.S. Department of Commerce and also worked for over a decade in multiple roles at the Federal Society, including as director of its publications and as deputy director of international affairs. So, Tyler, I'd like to turn to you now and ask you, let's go back to that era during the Obama administration where due process and sexual assault on campus was the emphasis. Could you kind of walk us through the federal policy enforcement changes on Title IX during the Obama years into the first Trump administration?
Of course. And thank you, Bob. And thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this really important conversation. From the outset, I just want to say that FIRE is proudly nonpartisan, and our interest in this Title IX discussion is limited to the way that the federal government has used Title IX to ask for censorship of protected speech on college campuses, or limited or denied or protected, as we'll talk about later, due process rights on college campuses. But going back to Bob's question of the what was going on in the late aughts and early 2010s is that there was a lot of pressure on the Obama administration from outside groups, victims advocacy groups and women's groups. And there's a big overlap between the two to really crack down on campus sexual misconduct. And going back many years, a couple decades, actually, federal courts had started to say that when institutions fail to respond to allegations of sexual misconduct or appropriately respond to them, that could create a hostile environment for women on campus that does constitute discrimination based on sex. And so with that in mind, the Obama administration started to figure out ways to urge universities to respond to these allegations. There was a lot of evidence that there was widespread reporting of sexual misconduct to universities by complainants, and universities just failed to respond or swept allegations under the rug or acted in its own institutional self-interest of protecting its reputation, protecting maybe the reputation of faculty or staff or even athletes on campus by dismissing these complaints without sufficient investigation. So that's what got us sort of to the what's called the 2011 Dear Colleague letter issued by the Department of Education, which was not a binding document. They disguised it as guidance, but wanted universities to follow it by requiring universities to, when they're investigating colleges for or investigating complaints of sexual misconduct, to use what's called the preponderance of the evidence standard. And before that time, there were a lot of institutions that used a higher standard, the clear and convincing evidence standard. And there were some of our elite institutions that even used beyond a reasonable doubt. Up until that time. And so in 2011, when the Department of Education says, no, the law, Title IX requires preponderance of the evidence, that was essentially a change in the state of the law that should typically require APA notice and comment, but that just wasn't followed. And subsequent to that, you know, we have that DCL and the 2014 question and answers on sexual misconduct that really started to push the scale in favor of complainants and against those accused of sexual misconduct on campus. And we had not only these threats to due process, but also threats to free speech. Let's go back to the speech side. There's one Supreme Court case in only one where the United States Supreme Court has defined what constitutes sexual harassment in the educational context. And that comes from a 1999 case called Davis versus Monroe County Board of Education. And in Davis, the court said that harassment is conduct that is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it effectively denies the student's access to an equal opportunity or benefit of an education. So that's a pretty high bar, and appropriately so. It's very speech protective. And in a settlement agreement with where the OCR and the Justice Department entered into a resolution agreement in 2013 with the University of Montana, requiring the University of Montana to adopt a definition of sexual harassment that just meant severe, pervasive, objectively offensive to any unwelcome conduct, including verbal conduct of a sexual nature. Now you can see there's a massive discrepancy between the Davis standard and that standard that the Obama administration forced upon the University of New Mexico. And in a press release announcing this resolution agreement, the department called this the blueprint for sexual harassment policies nationwide. So if you are a university general counsel seeing the Department of Education and OCR, which carries with it a lot of a big stick to take away all of your federal funding, what are you gonna do? Are you gonna follow the Supreme Court, or are you gonna follow this regulatory agency requiring you to adopt this unconstitutional policy? The result was many of these institutions chose to adopt this unconstitutional policy. A couple of years later, in a findings letter to the University of New Mexico, the department doubled down on that unconstitutional standard and said that sexual harassment is any unwelcome conduct, including verbal conduct, and that's just speech, of a sexual nature, regardless of whether it creates a hostile environment or is quid pro quo. So not only doubled down, they made it worse. Institutions were now forced under this sort of rubric that even if speech did not create a hostile environment, if it was unwelcome to the listener, they had to respond, the result of which was an enormous chilling dispatch. An enormous chilling effect on even very mundane speech related to a sexual nature. It was clearly unconstitutional. And subsequently to that, we had the various rescissions during the Trump administration of these guidance documents. And Bob, I don't know if you want me to go into more into the due process stuff or just wrap up here on the speech side.
Why don't you go a little bit into the due process stuff? Because sure. I think that is prove particularly problematic for institutions who have to go along with all this.
Okay. So I started going into the 2011 DC Dear Colleague letter, which required preponderance of the evidence. Again, FHIR thinks that is an inappropriate standard for adjudicating claims of this serious nature. And we have really, sort of incredible examples of how that's gone awry, of having, sort of like poorly trained, however well-intentioned, poorly trained campus administrators managing serious allegations of sexual misconduct rather than local law enforcement. We have the University of North Dakota. At University of North Dakota, Caleb Warner's girlfriend, alleged that he had committed some sort of sexual violence, and he was found responsible under a preponderance of the evidence standard and suspended for 3 years from school. And after the local police looked into this, they found that not only was he likely not guilty, they actually found that they wouldn't have charged him. They actually charged her with filing a false claim. And even after being presented with this evidence that the university had suspended him for 3 years, but that the local police had charged her with lying and creating a false report, they still wouldn't readmit him. And it wasn't until FHIR's advocacy, we had to jump in and correct this mistake. And it was to allow him to re-enroll in the school. And after that 2011 DCL, we also had the 2014 White House Task Force to protect students from sexual assault. And that report of one of the many suggestions was the administration saying that universities should use what's called the single investigator model, where one person is charged with investigating, drafting a report, making a determination of guilt or innocence, and then doling out punishment. We do not do that in the criminal context. There's a reason why in the criminal context, due process requires that these functions are separate and that the administration said that this would really help complainants, that it would streamline these investigations on campus. Whatever rationales there are to justify this single investigator model, it is clearly very at odds with fundamental notions of due process. And following the 2011 DCL and the White House Task Force report, due process violations were rampant. Under the old regime, which really only gave passing lip service to due process, if you look at these documents, they hardly talk about due process rights at all. According to Casey Johnson's litigation tracker, over 250 court cases across the country have issued some sort of ruling in favor of those accused of misconduct on campus, saying that the university violated some sort of ruling favorable to those individuals, either on the merits or at some sort of procedural stage. And one of the problems was that many Title IX administrators and victims' rights advocates viewed due process as an impediment to justice. And that just isn't true. Do you want to talk about 2020 rulemaking now, Bob?
We've sort of gotten through the changes, a general overview of the changes that the Obama administration did. There's frankly a backlash to mm-hmm. what they did. You read about it not just only in conservative policy and legal circles, but also civil libertarian circles and some traditional liberal circles as well. There's kind of a universal concern about what's happening here. President Trump is elected. Betsy DeVos comes into office as Secretary of Education. What happens then? What policy changes have occurred?
It was in September or August or September of 2017, shortly after the Trump administration came into office and Secretary DeVos was confirmed, that she rescinded the 2011 DCL and the 2014 Frequently Asked Questions document and announced that there was going to be federal notice and comment APA rulemaking on these issues, which was completely abandoned by the Obama administration. And back then it was Secretary Catherine Layman repeatedly said that we're just restating what the law is. We're not creating new legal obligations, when that clearly wasn't true. So we at FIRE applauded the Trump administration in its efforts to go through formal notice and comments rulemaking. And the result of it was a very good piece of rulemaking for both free speech and due process on campus. One of the things we said at the time was that document, that formal rule, took the rights of both complainants and respondents very seriously. It created rights for complainants, including rights to access counseling, even if the university couldn't prove claims, that it really focused on restoring a complainant's access to an educational environment while setting up these due process protections to ensure that if they are going to go through an investigation and punishment, they should have to go through and provide basic due process protections. Among those protections was an express presumption of innocence. And that was freakishly uncommon that a university would give a student an express presumption of innocence. And in fact, once this rule was finalized, there were folks on the other side who thought that even express presumption of innocence tipped the scale in favor of the accused in ways that were unfair to complainants, which shows you just how this pendulum had swung, that express presumption of innocence somehow were objected to by opponents. The rulemaking also required live hearings with cross examinations conducted by an advisor. Students are not allowed under this regime to directly cross examine the complainant or witnesses. And it allows for attorneys or an advisor of their choice who can be an attorney to do that. And they can also be there in the room with them. It requires sufficient time and information, including access to evidence to prepare for interviews and hearings. A lot of universities didn't even give students exculpatory evidence they had in their possession because the rule was the universities only had to provide evidence that they planned to use during the hearing. If the universities wanted to put their thumb on the scale and say, well, we're not planning to use this exculpatory evidence because we want to get this person out of here, they didn't have to turn it over. And so all the access, all the evidence in the institution's possession had to be shared with both parties, required impartial investigators and decision makers. It sort of did away with that single investigator model, thankfully, and it required that all relevant evidence received in an objective evaluation. So those are some of the basic procedural things that face a lot of objections from the other side that are, we think, really helped create an environment that where due process was respected, but also complainants' rights were respected at the same time.
So Sarah, let's shift gears here. It's 2020, the DeVos regulation is published, it's a sea change in Title IX, and particularly in regards to due process and free speech guarantees, but also in one thing that people forget is that regulation was the first time that the Department of Education actually decreed that sexual harassment was a violation of Title IX as a matter of law. Before then, it had been simply a question of interpretation.
And it was something I think about which we were incredibly gratified, Bob. I know having worked on the rule specifically, it was the first time that any regulation, any rule had clarified explicitly that sexual harassment, sexual assault are forms of sex discrimination under Title IX specifically. But we ultimately saw with one executive order, it was one of the first that he signed under the Biden administration, 13988, President Biden when he was in office and reinstituted Catherine Lehman back at the Civil Rights Office at Department of Education. He decreed in that executive order to all the executive agency heads, based on their interpretation of the Supreme Court's ruling in Bostock versus Clayton County in 2020, that all sex interpretations, all sex prohibitions in any federal law and regulation, and there are about 100 of them, ought to be expanded and interpreted to include gender identity, gender expression, or transgender status. So you can see what violence that does to every anti-prohibition on sex across the panoply of government agencies, whether HUD, Department of Justice, HHS, or the like. But I think for the Biden administration, the brass ring was very much Title IX, because Title IX is not solely implemented by Department of Education, but also in lesser extent by the Department of Agriculture and also by Department of Health and Human Services, because the anti-sex discrimination provision in Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, takes for its definition of sex discrimination Title IX's language explicitly. So this was really a three-for-one punch. But I think the Biden administration was keen not to be caught flat-footed on informal guidance anymore. And what they accomplished originally with the Dear Colleague letters in 2011, 2014, this time began in a notice of proposed rulemaking in 2022. To this day, historically, the comments, the public comments received, which were approximately 225,000 nationwide, are historically the biggest public stakeholder input that any federal agency rulemaking process has ever received. So that was sort of significant insofar as it reflected exactly where the culture was in terms of the level of passion that individuals had about going to the notion of sex discrimination and expanding it to include, to be commensurate with, transgender status and gender identity discrimination. Now, of course, for anybody who's an astute reader of the Bostock decision, we all understand the Bostock decision was very closely cabined. It was relegated specifically to Title VII. Justice Gorsuch anticipated, I think, what we all saw, which was the blowback that Justice Alito sort of presciently called to the fore by saying, this is now going to take into account everything from dress codes to pronouns to bathrooms. And Gorsuch sort of cavalierly, but to his credit, honestly, waved them off by saying there is no factual testing, no adversarial nature about which we can at this point weigh in. We are only talking about hiring and firing based on sexual orientation or transgender identity, because both are inextricably bound up with sex, with biological sex being, as Congress intended, the fulcrum of that anti-discrimination provision in Title VII, the two cannot be separated one for another. And without going too far down a field in a very long exposition on Bostock, which as anyone who knows me can understand, I'm more than capable of doing and willing to do, but going to
your favorite topics.
And of course, being limited as we are by time, the rulemaking that transpired in 2022 led ultimately to the development of two rules. There was a separate athletic rule development, which was for anybody really a compromise of no compromise. In fact, both left and right contingents, left and right advocacy organization, decried the rule as being fundamentally unfair because, for example, sex could be considered, biological sex could be considered in the collegiate level, but could not be considered in K through 12 levels, and especially so in the K through grade 6 levels, because at that point, the Department of Education ostensibly felt that there was no discernible difference in athletic capability between boys and girls. And for certain contact sports from grades 6 to 12, occasionally biological sex could be taken into account. So you see, it was an absolute hodgepodge that satisfied no one. And so as a result of sort of routine and universal cultural outcry, the rule itself was rescinded. But for anyone who is a careful reader of what that actual rule indicated and did not indicate. And more importantly, anyone who spent time pouring through the 2022 regulation, the Title IX rule itself, will understand, with language explicitly including things like all extracurricular activities, it was very clear that athletics were included in the 2022 rulemaking process themselves. And in fact, it wasn't until a separate rule was under development that anyone believed that athletics might be considered separately. But in the end, that was a distinction in search of a difference, because ultimately athletics were specifically included. Now, to take the term sex in a federal statute only 37 words long, something that was really the crown jewel of the women's liberation movement in the 60s and early 70s, and to expand it to transgender status and gender identity, did a significant amount of violence to the notion of women's equality, not just within athletic contexts, but within all sex-separated offerings within any educational, federally funded outlet across the country. And that includes everything from not just opportunities to win scholarships, but also to play on teams at all, because we are at this point talking about roster slots. We're talking about the opportunity to compete. We're talking about admissions scholarships, admissions slots. There are to this day still women's universities who are operating based on a 2015 interpretation, expansive interpretation from the Biden administration to include NATO men who present themselves as women within the ranks of women's only admissions. And I'm using very large air quotes here. So it had not just an impact on athletics, but also the opportunity to earn admissions slots, housing, private facilities, locker rooms, and the like. That is, to my mind, really sort of the biggest and most notable, and I think culturally relevant, based on exactly what the Biden administration promoted as sort of its cause du jour, which was transgender rights, something that Biden said himself in office were the civil rights cause of our era. Now, it also, unsurprisingly, and as Tyler sort of teed up for me, widened the scope of sexual harassment as well. No more were we adhering to the Davis versus Monroe standard of 1999, severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. Now you could pick any one of those. And objectively offensive standing by itself is really sort of subject to the interpretation of the eye of the beholder. So in addition, there was also an expansion of that term sex harassment to include in certain circumstances about which the Department of Education was entirely unspecific, any specific unwanted statement that might make an individual feel as though they are being sexually harassed, to include misgendering or failing to use an individual's preferred pronouns, which naturally constituted a heckler's veto across campuses coast to coast. Patently unconstitutional, that seemed to be of no concern for the Biden administration. It also infringed automatically, and as a result of this expansion of gender identitarianism, on parental rights, because with the interpretation of sex to include gender identity, and with commensurate things like privacy laws such as PPRA or FERPA, schools were under the inappropriate, incorrect notion that federal privacy law prevented them from what they called forcible outing of minor students' gender identities to their custodial parents, when in fact, those privacy laws say nothing of the kind. And in fact, both privacy laws indicate it is the parent who may exercise the privacy right until the minor gets to be 18 years and older. It also not only silenced free speech, but once again, we are back to the drawing board on the dilution of due process protections on college campuses. Once again, we are no longer permitting the use of a higher, clear, and convincing evidence standard, or even beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the de facto standard was preponderance of the evidence, which is really 50.1% as far as evidentiary burdens are concerned. There were no listing of qualifications of Title IX adjudicators online. line, nor even the process for which Title IX claims would be investigated online. That turned a lot of these campus investigations into what many of us refer to as kangaroo courts, with a series of roving commissars who would be judge, jury, and executioner for both the accused and the accuser themselves. It also eliminated a lot of the protections that we tried to institute with the 2020 rule, whether that be the offering of voluntary counseling or the mandatory reporting simultaneously to law enforcement to make sure that an individual who had potentially been sexually harassed, sexually abused, sexually assaulted could get also the benefits of law enforcement as well. So really what we saw was not just the sort of transgender expansion and that conflict automatically and significantly with the notion of women's equality, something which was ultimately the foundation for Title IX, the fulcrum on which the entirety of both the text of the law and its implementing regulations operate. We also saw these other manifestations through parental rights, heckler's veto, and First Amendment claims, due process rights, the notion of forced outing or the elimination of confidential information from custodial parents, and ultimately the perpetuation of kangaroo courts on college campuses, which is to say that there is really no overestimating the significance of the rule that was published in April 2024 during the Biden administration. Now, subsequent to that actual publication of the final rule, no fewer than 11 federal lawsuits were initiated within the first 8 weeks of that finalized rule, which was to take effect August 1st of 2024. Of those 11 federal lawsuits, the Biden administration lost either on a temporary or a permanent injunction every single time. And two federal courts actually went so far as to vacate the rule itself, which is a fairly extraordinary judicial remedy. The Supreme Court even itself weighed in only on an unsigned per curiam order in a case coming out of the Sixth Circuit, Tennessee versus Department of Education. And in that particular unsigned order, the justices said that all of them universally and unanimously agreed that the complainants were entitled to injunctive relief, including on the provision of the definition of sex to include gender identity or transgender status, which was significant. Obviously, we know going up on a request for injunctive relief, the standard there is whether or not an individual is likely to succeed on the merits. So while not saying so, it was very clear that the Supreme Court was telegraphing that Tennessee had a better than likely chance that on the merits, it was very conceivable that they would win their challenge as to the illegality of the actual Biden Title IX rule. So where we are now is ultimately back to the 2020 regulations. The Department of Education has made very clear that they're interpreting Title IX based on biological sex, that they are rewinding the clock back to the 2020 regulations with enhanced campus due process protections, with enhanced free speech protections. And while that is, I think, comfort to many of us, ultimately in the end, I think the positioning is that we will, in the end, need the Supreme Court to ultimately render final judgment so that we can bury that rule once and for all.
Thank you so much. One thing I'd like to do, Paul, before we get into perhaps a solution to this, is to take an issue and highlight what we consider, I think, is the problem here, this regulatory and policy whiplash that students in institutions have had to suffer. So, for instance, if you're to take the evidentiary standard that the federal government expects for an educational institution to use in connection with a campus Title IX disciplinary proceeding. In 2009, the schools were left to their own devices. So you had everything from clear and convincing to beyond a reasonable doubt to preponderance of evidence in varying degrees. In 2011, the federal government in sub-regulatory guidance said, well, no, actually, it needs to be preponderance of evidence. In 2017, the federal government said, we're going to rescind that requirement. You're back to what you want to do, or we're not going to coerce you either way. In 2020, the federal government came out with a regulation that said, it's your choice, preponderance of evidence, clear and convincing, but there can be no deviation between that which is used for students and that which is used for faculty. As an aside, that impacted some collective bargaining agreements arising from faculty unionization, and we wanted to ensure that students had the same due process rights as their unionized faculty. In 2024, the government said, no, sorry, it's actually clear and convincing. It's not preponderance of the evidence or anything else that you might choose. And then in late 2024, the rule was vacated, and we're back to the 2020 rule today. That's at least, six or seven changes just on this discrete issue as to what evidentiary standard an institution should use in connection with a campus Title IX disciplinary proceeding. That is whiplash, and that is difficult for anyone to follow. You can take that issue and extend it to the definition of sexual harassment, the scope of Title IX, whether it's gender identity or sex, what does sex mean, any number of issues. And so the question that arises, what do we do about it? Paul, why don't you talk a little bit about a legislative solution to this issue?
Sure, Bob, and thank you so much. I just want to start by saying it's good to be back at the Federalist Society. As Bob mentioned, I spent a lot of years there and appreciate all the work of Kayla and her team in having us and putting this together. So DFI, you know, this has been a wonderful introduction to this issue and to explain the whiplash, explain the kind of uncertainty and unpredictability that students, parents, institutions have been subject to over the years under Title IX. And so DFI has proposed a potential solution to this. It's called the Respect Title IX Act. I can unpack that acronym in the discussion if you want, or you can go to our website and take a look at that. But essentially what it does is to codify in the statute of Title IX answers to these questions that we've been talking about, answers to this whiplash, so that we have one regime that's not geographically based, depending on what federal judicial circuit you're in. And it doesn't depend on what administration currently holds the reins of power in Washington. And I'm happy to go into specifics on that, on our proposal, Bob.
Well, for instance, how does it address the issue of gender identity and sex?
Yeah, so it defines sex as a binary biological concept, which was the concept of sex when the law was written in 1972. Some people might question whether it needs to be defined because it was so clearly, the meaning was so clear in 1972. But I think Bostock, in the Title VII context, I think the Biden administration, its actions in the 2024 Title IX rule have cast this kind of penumbra of doubt over over Title IX and what its terms mean, that we really need to rectify and we need to put into law exactly what it means. And many states interpret sex to include this concept of gender identity as well in judicial circuits. So this is a fix to that issue to prevent future administrations and also states from changing the meaning of sex in Title IX.
And how is sex defined under the Respect Title IX Act?
So it is defined as a binary classification that is decided at birth, either male or female. And it explicitly does not include the concept of an individual sense, internal sense of gender identity that the Biden 2024 rule attempted to insert into the law.
And could you talk a little bit about how the law deals with the issue of single-sex sports, housing, and private facilities?
The law requires kind of truth in advertising. So if you have a bathroom that is for females It would require schools to only permit females into those bathrooms. If you have a sports team that is designated for females, you cannot permit biological males to participate in those. And housing, it's the same thing. And also the law requires that if you're a school that receives federal financial assistance under Title IX, you cannot force any individual to share an intimate facility like a bathroom or a locker room, or share your housing, share a bedroom, or on an overnight trip or in a dormitory with someone of the opposite sex. Just recognizing those rights to privacy and dignity that should not be that shouldn't be eviscerated by institutions as a condition of participating in their activities.
And talk a little bit about, I mean, it essentially incorporates the due process provisions of the 2020 regulations. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. In many different ways. I'm happy to get into that. Obviously, the single investigator model, it bans that model, and it requires access to evidence, requires schools to offer appeals, mandates live hearings with cross-examinations in higher education before you can kick someone out of school for sexual misconduct or sexual harassment. And of course, maybe most importantly, there's a presumption of non-responsibility for the conduct. So when a complaint is filed, you presume innocence. You don't presume that the person who is accused committed the misconduct.
And talk a little bit about how it handles the definition of sexual harassment.
It incorporates the Davis standard that we were discussing, the severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. So if you're going the administrative enforcement route, if you want a federal agency to enforce your rights under Title IX, you're not subject to a different standard under this law. It also recognizes that you should not you should not sweep aside someone's First Amendment rights to free speech in carrying out Title IX, and nothing in the statute should require institutions to be roving campus speech monitors and have bias teams that prevent anything offensive. We're talking about schools. We're not talking about the separate Title VII concept of the workplace, where perhaps more restrictions should apply.
Sarah had mentioned the issue and talked a little bit about the issue of parental rights. That's a hot issue now, has been, you know, intermittently since the mid 70s. How does this proposed legislation deal with the issue of parental rights, if at all?
The law, as I said, requires that schools do not restrict First Amendment rights. And it also incorporates for the first time parental rights in that formula. So nothing in Title IX requires a school to keep a secret from a parent about their child's social transitioning or anything else about their child under that law. Obviously, you could look under FERPA and you could say that would be a violation of the parents' rights. But we certainly say that in Title IX, you are not required to keep secrets from parents. You really, you should, as a policy matter, include parents in all the decision making that occurs.
And you're talking about some of these states and school districts that permit or even require school administrators to assist a student, is talking about K-12, to so-called transition to the other sex without the knowledge of the parents, or refer to that child by a different name without relevance to that child's biological sex. Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly right. So we have to recognize that Title IX doesn't require schools to sweep aside those parental rights to know what's happening with their kids in schools, and schools cannot base any inappropriate actions to that effect on this statute.
So I'm gonna encourage the audience to send us questions, which we'll try to answer before the conclusion of the webinar. And so if you would do that while I ask Paul a few more things about the Respect Act, Respect Title IX Act. There's a few aspects to this proposed legislation, to this model law for Title IX that we haven't talked about. One of them has to do with, you know, people should realize that the Title IX has within it an exemption for institutions run by bona fide religious organizations. This model law does address that issue, and I think it includes some strengthened protections for what we refer to as faith-based educational institutions. Could you briefly walk us through those?
Right. The law maintains the protections for faith-based institutions with contrary religious tenets, beliefs that counter Title IX. We set up a process by which religious institutions can ensure that the department is not going to violate their rights under Title IX, that the education department can ensure them that they are a religious institution with contrary tenets. It includes a process through which the Department of Education responds to these requests and kind of puts a little meat on the bones of how the education department should deal with religious institutions if someone files a Title IX complaint and the religious institution wants to put out there, hey, we're a religious institution with contrary religious tenets, so we're not subject to these particular requirements or any requirements of Title IX.
What does it do in terms of requiring a faith-based institution to seek that exemption from the Department of Education?
If you are a faith-based institution and you feel like you have contrary religious tenets, what you can do is you can submit a request for the department to affirm that religious exemption, and then you can hold that you can hold that affirmation. So if someone submits a complaint, you can point to that, and you can point that to the education department to that. It requires religious institutions also to, in terms of predictability, so everyone knows what their rights are on campus, to publish publish that kind of affirmation on their website, so that students understand that that institution is not subject to Title IX, and they know what their rights are under the Title IX regime, and what rights they're not entitled to.
In that exemption process is completely voluntary.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. Talk a little bit about how the Respect Title IX Act deals with this issue of rulemaking and sub-regulatory guidance. But it's kind of a rather not unique, but perhaps an aggressive posture on the issue of federal rulemaking and guidance.
I can quickly go through that and say that the current Title IX requires agencies, all federal agencies that deal with education funding, to set up rules and regulations and orders of general applicability to enforce Title IX's requirements. Our proposal would get rid of that requirement. And in fact, in recognition of the amount of the amount of manipulation of the statute, the amount of back and forth and tug of war between administrations and states over this issue, it would deny to federal agencies the authority to issue such rules and regulations and orders of general applicability, with the idea that if you want to know what your rights are, we have provided them in statute. We have put those, we've codified those, they're a permanent fixture, and they're not going to change over time. So we're hoping to increase predictability and stop this kind of tug of war manipulation between different education departments and other agencies, obviously, that enforce Title IX by making these permanent fixes and not allowing further rulemaking and regulations.
Great. We've got one question here, and it refers to the litigation filed by the federal government against the California Department of Education and the California Interscholastic Federation, who have refused to change their policies that allow transgender athletes to compete in female sports. And the question is, do you think there will be true change within these more liberal states that refuse to change, or will legal battles continue to pile up? What is the solution here? Sarah, you want to take that?
Yeah. I actually love this question because it's, I think, what a lot of people are thinking, right? So we've seen, obviously, the Department of Justice give the main treatment to California Interscholastic Federation and the California Department of Public Instruction. Specifically, this goes to the nature of Title IX as being spending clause law, right? So it's very clear that when Congress enacts spending clause law, it works in the nature of a contract between the federal government and the state government. Now, California doesn't need to accept federal funding. Maine doesn't need to accept federal funding. But when they do, they have to certify every single year that they will follow the interpretation that the Department of Education has laid out for Title IX, to wit, biological distinctions between male and female. At any point, they don't have to continue to take federal funding, but we understand that that's a very attractive proposition for most of these states, even though, and I'll drop a very brief footnote here, about 70-80% of all of the funding for education comes specifically from states as opposed to the federal government. Nonetheless, we're still talking about millions and billions of dollars. I do, in the end, in addition to this law, which I think is such a great solution to preventing the manipulation of the plain text of the law going back and forth between administrations, I think ultimately we will need a final judgment from the Supreme Court, and it may very well be coming as soon as the fall 2025 term, specifically because not only now do we have federal legislation in the First Circuit and the Ninth Circuit that will go up, but the Supreme Court's already accepted cert in two specific cases, another out of the Ninth and one out of the Fourth Circuit, challenging the constitutionality of women's sports protection laws. Are those laws a violation of the Equal Protection Clause and Title IX when they make very clear biological distinctions between males and females are important and something for which the state legislatures enacted in their democratic authority to be able to implement the spirit and purpose of Title IX. So I think between what we've seen in terms of the federal government's positioning right now in litigation and the two cert grants that we've just seen, we may get clarity on this within this calendar year.
Yeah. And it, you know, I think it's important to point out it could make the sort of the definitional aspects of sex in the Respect Title IX Act moot, which I think underscores, Tyler, the importance of its the Act's due process provisions. Because due process is not mentioned anywhere in Title IX. There's no reference to due process in Title IX. That is simply an extension of how to protect against sexual harassment and what the institutional response by university or college or K-12 institution to an allegation of sexual harassment and how you handle those and what the expectations are. It seems to me that this due process element aspect of this issue needs to be on, you know, firm statutory ground.
I think I agree. I was just going to say that there have been some critics of the Trump administration's rulemaking saying exactly that, Bob, that due process is mentioned nowhere in that 37 words of Title IX. We've long argued, however, that if the federal government is going to be requiring universities to investigate and adjudicate these allegations, they also can't be forcing universities to, or recipients of federal funding, to violate constitutional rights. And that's what so many institutions were doing. So clarifying what the constitutional rights are, what they are, like how they're implicated and how the universities can protect these constitutional rights is permissible, and if not required, so that universities aren't just railroading students in these kangaroo courts and losing in court when accused students bring their due process claims.
Let's go to another question real quick. We have about a minute left. Is there any way that you can include specific language, I presume, in the proposed statute stating that nonviolent speech or speech calling for death or physical harm or injury is not considered hate speech?
Tyler, I think there's something for this. It might not be necessarily this particular legislation that DFI has put together, but I think that there are ways, other legislation out there where this is a bit implicated, including last session's Respecting the First Amendment on Campus Act, which passed the House of Representatives in September or October before the elections in 2024. Hasn't been brought up again this year, but there are many speech protections included in that piece of legislation. And we at Fire hope it's reintroduced or at least considered again now that we're done with the big, beautiful bill.
Great. All right. Any concluding thoughts before we adjourn? We're at 1 o'clock. All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been a great presentation. Very much appreciate your participation.
I would love to echo those thanks and jump in here. Thank you so much to our panel for joining and participating. It was a fabulous discussion. We really appreciate you taking this section out of your day and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.